The tiny Persian Gulf state of Kuwait is still in mourning a week after the passing of the nation's emir, Sheikh Jabbar al-Ahmad al-Sabah. The crown prince and heir apparent is believed to be largely incapacitated by ill health, and the royal family announced late last week that the country's prime minister will continue to run the government. That raised eyebrows among some in Kuwait, but few changes are expected in the country's oil policies or its strong support for the United States. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Kuwait City.
Thousands of Kuwaitis clogged the beach road last Thursday in a march to show their affection for the late emir. But when the Kuwaiti cabinet named Crown Prince Sheikh Saad al-Abdullah al-Sabah as the 14th emir of Kuwait in accordance with the constitution, questions began to arise about Sheikh Saad's own failing health. Something of a national debate broke out over whether he was even capable of reading the oath of office, with some arguing it should be shortened so as not to embarrass him. Analysts say despite friction among branches of the royal family over whose turn it is to lead, there was never any serious fear of a leadership crisis. With both the emir and crown prince ill in recent years, Prime Minister Sheikh Sabah al-Ahmad al-Sabah has been running the government and will continue to do so. Political scientist Abdullah Sheji at Kuwait University believes the royal family is keenly interested in sending a message of stability to the rest of the world on global issues. The main question is whether Sheikh Sabah will enact more reforms at home.
There is a clear continuation of policy. Sheikh Sabah has been on the helm as a prime minister for since 2003. He's been forming cabinets for the last 10 years. This guy is a reformist. He's the person who led the fight to give women suffrage in May 2005.
One woman who intends to run for parliament next year, Rula Dashti of the Kuwait Economic Society, says Kuwaitis have confidence in the royal family. But in her view, they are ready for political and economic reforms, as well as the continuing push for women's rights.
Social reform, we're talking about the role of women in society and in public life, because we do believe that this will determine, let's say, the struggle between modernity ideology and patriotic extremism ideology, which they do believe that the role of women to be contained only as a housewives, while we do believe that women has to build on that role, to be a citizen and to participate in the development process.
Another area where the prime minister is pushed for reform, a bit too cautiously for some, is in loosening the government's grip on Kuwait's highly centralized economy. One result of Kuwait's vast oil wealth has been a cradle-to-grave welfare system that will be difficult to overhaul. The benefits are staggering. Free education, including college, free health care, interest-free 30-year housing loans, heavy subsidies for electricity, water, and other essentials. With oil prices soaring and Kuwait sporting a $20 billion surplus, few are complaining. But columnist and economic analyst Amer Tamimi warns that Kuwait needs to plan for the day after oil wealth, and that includes reining in the welfare state. The problem, he says, is the Kuwaiti parliament, where members can see only as far as the next election.
They don't want to privatize government entities, especially utilities like electricity, telecommunication, because they think that there will be price rise, and many of those consumers are their voting base. If you look at the Kuwaiti labor force, you find that 94% of that labor force works for the government.
Kuwaitis realize that beyond their borders, interest in this country no larger than New Jersey is largely limited to questions of the price of oil and whether Kuwait will continue to cooperate with post-war operations in Iraq. Analysts say that seems to be Kuwait's fate as the owner of valuable real estate in a dangerous neighborhood. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Kuwait.